And Jesus said, "You have heard it said to the men of old, 'You shall not kill,' and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be liable to the hell of fire." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. Those of us who have brothers or sisters or spouses can take little comfort from those words of Jesus. With those close to us getting angry, hurling insults, and yelling, "You fool," or more likely, "You idiot," which actually expresses the Greek better, becomes second nature. In fact, if we're honest, the entire Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5 to 7, stands as an enormous challenge to the way we do most things most of the time. This summer at Wyoming Catholic College's high school program, which is called PEAK, theologian Jeremy Holmes taught the Sermon on the Mount, and I asked him how comfortable or uncomfortable Jesus' words made the students, beginning with the Beatitudes.
You know, I think the students had a hard time taking the words in. They're so far from our typical expectation. Jesus suggests this picture in which the depressed are the blessed, you know, and I actually use that phrase. Is he saying that it's blessed to be depressed and let them chew on that for a while? And they eventually worked around to, no, that is not what the mournful means. But it took them a while to absorb that Jesus is proposing a radical new end of life. I think it's hard for a lot of...
And as in telos.
End as in the goal of life.
Right.
Right. I think a lot of Catholics think about morality in terms of obeying commandments. And of course, yes, there are commandments which are absolute boundaries that we have to stay inside, but morality is not a matter of being inside the boundaries. It's a matter of where you go within the boundaries, right? The staying inside the boundaries is like not veering off the race course, but it makes a great deal of difference whether you're heading towards the finish line or not. And Jesus in the Beatitudes gives us a picture of the finish line that just does not accord with the usual picture we have. And it's so radical a message. My experience is that most people aren't shocked initially because it's hard to even hear.
Mm-hmm. Blessed are you when men persecute you and revile you and say all manner of evil against you for my sake.
Which is very easy in a kind of holy card mentality to read and think, yes, with my hands folded, I agree. Blessed are those in that condition. When you're actually in the condition on the ground and someone wants to perhaps shut down your bakery because you won't make a specific cake, then I think that these words will light up for you and perhaps actually provide some consolation.
What other texts did you discuss with the students?
Well, first we looked at the context of the Sermon on the Mount to make clear the action running up to the Sermon on the Mount is essentially Jesus is unwillingly in Egypt. He comes out of Egypt. He goes through the water, out into the wilderness, and then up on a mountain and gives a law. 100% clear, Matthew is presenting Jesus as Moses. So, as one who speaks with authority and not as the scribes, as it says at the end. Matthew's not done. He goes on over the course of the gospel. Jesus gives four more great discourses after the Sermon on the Mount for a total of five. Again, reflecting the five books of the Pentateuch, traditionally called the books of Moses. So we situated the Sermon on the Mount as the new Moses giving the new law first. And then broke that down into its parts, looked at the Beatitudes. There's a section in which Jesus interprets the law. You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. There's another further section in which Jesus talks about how to practice personal piety, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And a final section where Jesus addresses sort of how do you deal with the world, the practical things like money and annoying people around you. And then a closing section corresponding, as the Beatitudes open with blessings, there's a section that closes with warnings if you don't take his words seriously enough. So we try to do at least one thing with each of those major sections.
One of the "you have heard, but I say" has to do with anger. Anyone who is angry with his brother should be liable for judgment. Whoever insults his brother should be liable to the council. Whoever says "you fool" shall be liable to the hell of fire. How do we understand that?
This was the text that finally set the students off. This was where the shock value of the Sermon on the Mount began to sink in for them. They realized, I pointed out to them that Jesus himself calls people fool within the Gospel of Matthew. So that there's a paradox right there. But they tried to picture what a society would be like if all the good people behaved strictly according to these words, and they began to envision for themselves a society in which no one stands up for the oppressed, where everyone is a wet noodle before the wicked. And with that vision in front of them, they began to seriously ask themselves how they should interpret the Sermon on the Mount. At one point, we had a proposal which was startling in its radicality, that perhaps Jesus doesn't even mean us to follow these words. Perhaps this is a beautiful but unattainable ideal that we can approximate but can't really achieve. That didn't survive this test of evidence, as we found Jesus at the end of the Sermon on the Mount saying, "Anyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them," well, actually, is a fool. So we found that we were really driven to ask deeper questions about, when you're angry, how can you be angry rightly? You know, say, how can I be angry the way Jesus became angry in the temple and drove out the money changers, versus what is being condemned here in the Sermon on the Mount? What is wrong anger exactly? What is wrong anger really? One distinction that I thought was helpful is, as useful as it is familiar, it's more helpful to be angry at the unjust deed than at the unjust person. If you find that what your anger is driving you to do is simply inflict harm, that's what you want, that's a bad anger. Whereas if your anger is driving you to bring about justice, that would be a good anger. So we were considering how to read the words of Jesus in light of as continuing the Old Testament repression of the inclination to personal vengeance.
Now let's move on to judging others. "Judge not that you be not judged." Well, okay, but Jesus, followed by St. Peter, St. Paul, St. John, St. James, and made a lot of judgments, and even judged lots of people. What's going on with that?
This was also a fun conversation we ran for quite a while with the picture that would emerge if no one could exercise judgment on what is going on around them. And it is a silly picture. When someone brought up that Jesus, as you point out, makes a lot of judgments, someone initially tried to defend that by pointing out that, well, Jesus is, in fact, God and appointed as the judge of the world, and the rest of us aren't. Maybe this is just one of those places where he gets to do things we don't get to do. That didn't survive the test of scrutiny. The distinction that ended up carrying the day in our conversation was the distinction between two activities that a judge must carry out. A judge is someone who must review the evidence and reach a conclusion about what's true, but a judge is also someone who must pass sentence. And what we found is that Jesus himself, right within the same passage where he says, "Judge not," he also says, "Don't cast your pearls before swine, or give what is holy to dogs," which is immediately asking you to judge who around you is a pig or a dog. So we were driven to the conclusion that "judge not" is saying, don't pass sentence. If you see someone being wicked, you can know, there's no reason you can't know, that's a wicked deed. But you can't then internally say, okay, hell for you. If you do that, then one day Jesus will appear in front of you and say, okay, hell for you.
Now, we repeat part of the Sermon on the Mount 1, 2, 3 times a day, which is the Our Father. How does the Our Father fit in, and how does Jesus teach us to pray?
Discussions around the Our Father were some of my favorites this past week. The text is situated right at the center of the sermon, sort of if you count out the words, it's right about at the middle of the text of the Sermon on the Mount. And I asked the students to think about how the Our Father is organized. And there were various suggestions, some of them familiar, like, there's the part that concerns God, and then the part that concerns men, a similar division to the Ten Commandments. But one student observed that the Our Father seems to be arranged in couplets. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Those two are both a present need. I've already got sins that need forgiven. I'm hungry. Then we move on to future needs. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Nice set of couplets. Someone else, piggybacking on that suggestion, observed a descent. We start in heaven, our Father who art in heaven. Then we ask that kingdom in heaven descend to the earth. You know, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy kingdom come. And then once our vision is down on earth, we start asking about earthly needs. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our sins. But then our attention continues on down to the realm of Satan, to hell, and deliver us from the evil one. So that there's a sort of the eye of the imagination scans from heaven all the way down through earth and into the depths of hell and covers all of that with prayer. Finally, we considered St. Augustine's tantalizing suggestion that you can line up the petitions of the Our Father one for one with the Beatitudes. We found some parts of that suggestion more convincing than others, but there are some remarkable alignments. For example, when you get to "Blessed are the pure of heart," it lines up with "Lead us not into temptation." So that is an intriguing proposal that I would encourage anyone to sit down with pen and paper and consider.
What should we take away from the Sermon on the Mount? What did Jesus intend for his original hearers and therefore for us?
The Sermon on the Mount demands of us that we be perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect. And it spells out at least some of what that would mean. And if we're listening attentively, it should be enough to drive us to fear, to ask ourselves, is this too much? But the Sermon on the Mount itself contains an assurance. Hopefully you have started to feel afraid by the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Hopefully you've started to think to yourself, Jesus, are you serious? Can I do this? Can I really be perfect as my Father in heaven is perfect? And this is the point where Jesus says, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock, the door will be opened. What you need to do what I'm saying will be provided. You have only to turn back to me, to the lawgiver, for that grace that you need.
As we read the Sermon on the Mount, indeed, as we read the Gospels, we have to keep in mind what Pope Benedict XVI said in his book, Jesus of Nazareth. Quote, Jesus' teaching is not the product of human learning of whatever kind. It originates from immediate contact with the Father, from face-to-face dialogue, from the vision of the one who rests close to the Father's heart. It is the Son's word. Without this inner grounding, his teaching would be pure presumption. Close quote. So in faithfulness to Jesus, the Son, we wrestle with the Scriptures, with our fallen human natures, with our consciences as we grow into the people Jesus intends us to be, the salt of the earth and the light of the world. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.